Welcome on to this meeting. The order of business is, I believe, as per the agenda, or is there any changes required? None?
No changes.
Okay, declarations of interest can be made at any time. Any apologies?
Apologies from Councillor Bennett, Coventry, Montgomery, Muirhead, Russell and Young.
Okay, move on to items 4.1, Communities in Education Performance Reporting. Ian.
Thank you, Chair. I do the Communities and Economy, and I'll keep it fairly brief for my voice collapses. Just to summarise, I mean, obviously, the paper's before you, and that shows the progress under those various headings and also the emerging challenges, a couple of which I'll pick up on. But in terms of strategy, then the Strategic Development Plan number 2, as you know, is has just completed its period of notification, and the expectation is that the procedures to go through the examination and then final approval by ministers will be completed by the middle of next year. So we would then have an up-to-date strategic development plan in place. That's the plan that will then dictate or be the framework for the next Midlothian local development plan, not the current one. The current one is currently at examination, and the expectation is, again, that we will see the final adoption of that, the report back from the Scottish Government reporters, and the final adoption of that in the middle of next year. We then have a fully up-to-date position in relation to development plans, which is a strong position to be in relation to planning ahead for new housing and service provision. Just to remind you that the Strategic Development Plan number 2 does not require and does not show a need for any further housing developments over and above the local development plan, which is currently examination, up to the period of about 2029, 2030. And that enables us to, in fact, have some sort of breathing space in challenging or dealing with the challenge of ensuring that we see that housing come forward in a proper way and with proper servicing to accompany it. City deal is the only other strategic one to mention. It got a mention in the Chancellor's autumn statement, which was to the effect that they're still progressing, the UK and Scottish Government's progressing with the six Lothian area of South East Scotland area authorities towards a city deal, with the hopefully an announcement being in the spring of next year. Just the other major item I want to mention is the Borders Rail Line. We're still very much in the honeymoon period of the Borders Rail Line post-opening, and there is a fair amount of effort going into inward investment through the websites, through contacts, through the work of the consultant we have acting for us. There are master plans being kicked off in relation to in four parts of the Borders Rail Line corridor, but two specifically in Midlothian at Newton Grange Town Centre and at Stob Hill. The tourism destinations study is underway. That's a £350,000 externally funded, in terms of the council's involvement, externally funded at work to boost tourism development, to capitalise on the new rail line. Hotel market assessment work is being done at a relatively modest cost, and that really is to try and crack some of the problems we've had over the past in really understanding just what the hotel market is. Plenty of sites get allocated, very few hotels ever get built. And also in particular locations, particularly Gore Bridge, then the expectation is we will be looking at an overall scheme to be funded by the Borders Rail Blueprint Fund primarily, which will see further public realm improvements to the roads in the centre of Gore Bridge and also bringing that station building back into a beneficial use. A couple of other things to mention. There's been, during the quarter two, there was a submission of the bid for the £3.8 million scheme of improvement at Pennycook Town Centre, and the two key agencies we're bidding to are the Heritage Lottery Fund and Historic Environment Scotland. We had what I thought was a pretty successful day taking them round in October. We expect to see the results probably first from the lottery fund, which is critical, in January, and thereafter from Historic Environment Scotland. So we just wait to see what those come up with. In terms of the quarter two performance levels, I'm glad to say that we're now back up to the high levels of performance in the handling of planning applications post the review of the planning service, which was completed earlier in the year. Just to pick on challenges, I'll probably identify three. One will not be any surprise to members. It's really this question of supporting of services, the provision of services, infrastructure to support the scale and rate of new housing developments coming forward. The development plan and the supplementary guidance on developer contributions and the action programme all set the provision for a planned approach to that. But there are stresses and strains. Members will be aware of those, and I think one of our top priorities is to, and challenges is to deal with that. We have to deal with the impact of Brexit on the business community itself in terms of business confidence. The higher education sector, which is probably ones that those who have a view that Brexit was not what was wanted would probably point to the higher education sector as an area which is probably most severely challenged, let's put it that way. But also in terms of just financing EU funding programmes, such as LEADER programme, what I understand is that there have been, after initial sort of serious concerns about the programmes being cut off very quickly, there appeared now to be assurances that existing programmes, by and large, will be allowed to see their time out, certainly long before there's the conclusion of the actual exit under the Section 50 rules. And the last area of challenge is really this whole issue of empowering communities through the implementation of the Community Empowerment Act, which has so much to it, and it's trying to do that at a time of a challenge to the public sector resources, which this council and no doubt all other councils are facing. Chair, that's just a general run round and a thumbnail sketch of where we are on the sort of Q2 side of things. More than happy to pick up on any of that and any of the details in the report.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks, Chair. Just to pick up on one item here, that you've got the last bullet point within serving communities, management of a second incident of carbon dioxide gas ingress into residential properties in Gorebridge. But also, just like to ask you a general question about, you're talking about hopefully we'll get a lull in development, residential development in Midlothian to give us a chance to catch up on some of the infrastructure issues. One part of the infrastructure that we don't seem to be able to do much with is the road network. And I know we're working on an active and sustainable transport strategy at the moment, which I'm keen to see progress. I'm just wondering what kind of things will hopefully be in that and in the council's overall plan to address the issues of congestion on the roads.
Just to pick up on the the second incident. As you know, there was the original incident at New Byers Crescent. We all know what the end point of that was. We have since September, and local members have been kept informed on this, we have since September experienced further CO2 gas ingress into properties which are owned by Melville Housing Association at New Byers Avenue, which is a little further away. At the moment, there are perhaps no more than about half a dozen properties which are particularly affected. There have been some decants of tenants by Melville Housing Association. Clearly, the situation is one which is being taken very seriously, and indeed, Chief Executive has just come from chairing an internal meeting of officers to look at all aspects of this and to keep keep more than a watching brief, to keep an action brief on how we deal with this. There are certain measures which we have now started to put in place, one of which is that as we now have a second incident, then in terms of the building standards and the way we operate those, we've put in place an interim policy which will now require within a defined Gorebridge area, which is basically the built-up area plus the areas allocated for development, well, there will be a requirement for all residential properties to have fitted sufficient gas protection measures to avoid the ingress of mined gas, which would include CO2. But it's very much a movable feast at the present time. clearly there's a balance to be had between ensuring that we look after the safety of our residents and the community, but equally not taking draconian measures, if you like, which are simply going to create alarm and create a sense of unease and uncertainty, which may be ill-founded. So it's a question of just being on top of this, which we are at the present time, and taking it forward, and obviously keeping members and the public informed as we make progress. There is what's called an incident management team being arranged. That's through the NHS. There was an incident management team for the first incident at Newbyres Crescent. There's one that's been set up for this, and again, that ensures that all the health end of this is covered and coordinated with what the council are doing. In relation to the residential development which is coming forward through the local plan, in a sense, although the lull, I think, is that there is not more housing having to be found. But in terms of the rates of development, we will still see those running at, I suspect, somewhere between 600 and 700 a year for best part of 10 years, I suspect. We'll see that sort of rate of development. Beyond that, the market won't really stand it. So it's more a question of saying, right, well, allying that with the action programme, which is in the local plan. In relation to road congestion, just on the issue of the sort of green travel plan and what's happening with that, probably Ricky Moffitt better this afternoon. In terms of the work we would do with in bringing forward development, keeping it brief, where development is being proposed in the local plan, substantial areas of housing, we will have worked through and include in the local plan what the interventions are needed in terms of transport access, and therefore those which we can identify and lay at the door of the development, we will take developer contributions up to whatever level is appropriate in terms of the consequential impact. Over and above that, if we have windfall sites come forward, then again we can apply the developer contributions requirements to those windfall site developers. I agree that's in a sense, that's fine, that takes us as far as we go. In relation to the overall network, then I think it's the issues of policy in relation to public transport, which takes us into the whole area of public transport subsidies, green travel plans, parking restrictions where we have maximum parking areas. All of those things are really something which comes through the planning process, but also allies with what my colleague Ricky Moffitt is doing on the transport side.
Sorry, just want to follow up with one quick question. You seem to indicate there that in the wider Gore Bridge area that you're talking about putting in gas safety solutions. Why are you not spreading that across all mining areas in Midlothian? Why are you only in the Gore Bridge area?
Yeah, Chair, this is one we've really debated long and hard. The evidence that the evidence of incidents of gas of gas ingress is in the Gorebridge area. We've had none elsewhere. That we have no recorded incidents of CO2 gas intrusion. We've therefore said, well, the policy, which is the interim policy, goes beyond what is provided for in the building regulations. In the Building Standards Act, which councils have to abide by, then you are simply asking or ensuring that what is built is in accordance with those regulations. So as long as they meet those regulations, they get a tick in the box, they get their warrant, they get their completion certificate. What's being asked for here is over and above that and is subject to challenge. We have consulted with Scottish Government Building Standards Division on this, and in essence their response in correspondence was that, as I've just said, they're saying, well, you're going beyond what the building standards are requiring here. And to some extent, you're on your own. I mean, in fairness to them, not in a sense of them being dismissive, but they're saying, obviously, you're then going beyond that. They're not objecting to what we're doing. They think it's a reasonable precautionary principle approach that we're adopting. We are saying it's an interim policy, and that a part of that interim policy is to give developers and experts in the field of ground contamination the opportunity to come back to us and suggest ways in which they think that this outcome of ensuring that the lack of gas ingress can be achieved. So there's a degree of comfort there. We've talked, for example, to all the developers, talked to Persimmon. They're anxious, but again, as I said, they're not rushing off to the courts to challenge us. They want to talk it through with us. I think the issue we came to a conclusion on in terms of the wider area was, it's that balance between saying there clearly is an issue of some sort in Gore Bridge. We can't be 100% sure that it is mined gas, although we can be pretty sure that's what it is. There's no basis at the present time to extend that to all of Midlothian. That could come later, but I think it needs to be an evidential base. And part of the discussion which occurred in the meeting which just preceded this one, which Chief Executive chaired of officers, was to say that we need to set up some, and we have set up, some further smaller subgroups of officers to take forward, looking at the evidence across, certainly Gore Bridge, but using as an evidence base to inform how we might want to take this interim policy forward.
Okay, thank you for that. Brian, then Lisa.
Yeah, I've been shared with all the information on the Gore Bridge situation and had the meetings with Melville Housing, etc. I can share that information with you. It was one block of four, you know, and one particular house was concerning in that row of four houses, and they've all been decanted and satisfactorily decanted, you know, where the customer focused on that. My points that was going to come in was on, basically, we've mentioned the Borders Rail Blueprint Fund on three different paragraphs here. The paragraph in serving communities for the Newton Grange Town Centre and Stob Hill. On the paragraph of economic development, substantial funding, twice in that paragraph. Obviously, Newton Grange is very close to my heart, and regeneration and development is very much positive. Realignment, replacement, you know, restructuring, isn't it? You know, the Borders Railway Blueprint Legacy Fund, I'm trying to see that has got added value in this for the Newton Grange Town Centre, and the references to the Blueprint Master Plan, there isn't actually just now a blueprint or a master plan. There's potential for a master plan and a potential for the monies. My kind of specific questions would be the level of money that's available for this, the timelines on this money, use it or lose it, you know, is the kind of thoughts I've got. And again, similar to your Leader Plus comments, you know, no new projects seem to be, but you know, would this qualify as a new project, or is this potentially a part of our Leader funding as well for the regeneration? And not forgetting Stob Hill, but Newton Grange Town Centre Master Plan. Just what stages are we at and what timelines are we on it? The discussions at the Community Council last night, some of them were quite cynical, you know, that there'll be no decisions or no developments till after the next election. I just wonder if you can assure that you know, that is not hindering the progress of this and not putting anything at risk. For the funding potential. And if I can just go on to my second point about community engagement. You know, the communities are, there must be a saturation point for consultation processes. You know, there's that many of them out there just now, you know, from the council and from other organisations and from third sector consultations as well. You will get to, and community planning conference, and you know, taking on board a lot of the issues that have been raised at the community planning conference. But everything seems to be talked about building capacity of community councils or community engagement. And I'm seeing a bit of apathy again now. You know, I'm not seeing bigger tendencies at community councils. And I'm, you know, and some of them are maybe a bit tired, you know, and it's so hard to engage with community councils unless we've got that fresh blood, you know, and the fresh impetus within the community councils. And I'll leave it at that, just if you can alert me.
Okay. The proposal is that there will be master plans undertaken for, as you say, for Newton Grange Town Centre and for Stob Hill. The money for that was assured by the Blueprint Fund. That's part of the £10 million Blueprint Fund, which was identified by the former First Minister to kickstart, if you like, capitalising on the benefits of the new Borders Railway across Scottish Borders and Midlothian Council areas. In terms of the total value, it's a value of £300,000, which is £150,000 from the Blueprint Fund, and that's matched from Midlothian Council. In relation to the progress on that, then the two are separate master plans. They will be undertaken by consultants. The work to secure consultants is at the tender stage, and so we'd expect the selection of the consultants to be early in the new year. In terms of the words master plan and blueprint, I equally find those actually not very helpful here, because it always suggests a degree of dictation of just what it's all going to look like. Here's a blueprint, so you can't change it. The aim very clearly here, and in terms of tendering and in terms of getting the right consultants on board, is about engaging at the community level. And I think I share your concerns about the fact that obviously if you have just a number of community leaders, it's a lot of pressure on them. And I think what we will be requiring from these consultants who work closely with us is going to be getting to the wider community and getting a much greater span of community input, if I can put it that way. Now, to some extent, that was highlighted when Mary Smith, the director, and myself went along to the community council at the end of September, and really to try and assure the community that that was the way in which this was going to be undertaken. There is clear opportunity for, there's something of a blank canvas at Newton Grange, in as much as you have a number of land uses, a number of vacant sites within the town centre area, and I won't go into lots of detail, but there is a great opportunity to look at how you might want to regenerate Newton Grange. It's not highly constrained in terms of what options there could be, and that's something which I think is really going to be one thing which the community can latch on to. So that's the position in terms of where we are with those master plans, but clearly the one for Newton Grange Town Centre is the one which is going to be clearly more needing of the right sort of careful approach to the way in which the value of the community input is properly realised.
Lisa, then Peter.
Thank you, Derek. On that last point specifically, if I can pick up on that one, my concern is, it may have misunderstood, but are you actually saying, Ian, that there are two separate planning groups going forward, one of which will be Midlothian Council-led, and therefore different groups of consultants? Because that's worrying when we see how often consultancy fees massively chew into available funds for any project. And if that's the case, there's two parallel plans. Is there any way of working more closely and combining? I have three other questions, so I don't know if you want to take them in order or one by one.
Sorry, I'll take that one first. There will be clearly a cohesion between the two master plans, and that's the responsibility of probably myself and others to coordinate that. There's probably potentially, if it's the same consultants, so be it, but there's potentially an advantage because they're two very different ones. The one, as I say, for Newton Grange Town Centre is very much a community-based one. The one for Stob Hill is perhaps a more commercial, industrial strategy-led, because that includes land which is in the council's ownership, also land which is owned by the National Mining Museum. It's their industrial area. And it's really looking at how decisions about those areas, and there's probably issues in relation to all of those, is how that can be most effectively coordinated to the benefit of Newton Grange community at the end of the day, but also capitalising on the wider Borders Rail. So I think it's incumbent on the officers in Midlothian Council and the Borders Rail coordinator to ensure that coordination is there, they would be accountable on that particular issue.
Thank you. My other questions are around the local plan and the fact that we have seen these episodes in Gobridge. How much are you tapping into the Scottish Government's Building Standards Group with reference to seismology? Seismologists across the globe are telling us we've never seen so much seismological activity ever in recorded history at this time. And there's a number of events that are being attributed to causing that. Given that that may be the case, and accepting the premise of these professionals, how much are we referencing our building standards against that new information? And how much are we able to influence the Scottish Government's building standards to reconsider and review in the light of this information? Because while we're talking about carbon dioxide detectors, that's obviously highly desirable when we know there's a potential risk. But where we can be proactive and learn from the experience we have had and information that's emerging now with new technology enabling this emerging information to be more up to speed, more up to date, and more accurate and all-embracing than we've seen ever before, surely that could actually save... we could get far behind this in such a way that we're not chasing events, we're actually influencing how and where we build based on that experience. And it seems to me we could be missing an opportunity for us to cast the benefit of a very unfortunate episode here in Midlothian, which could easily be replicated elsewhere, given we are very much an area of mining that extends way beyond Midlothian. That's one. My other one is also crystal balling, and it's around the Brexit impact and the fact that the local plan put in place did not anticipate Brexit, as almost no one did, apparently, even the Brexiteers. So accordingly, given that we know the impact or potential impact on places like QMU, we know that a lot of the young people and older people who attend courses at QMU may well be losing funding. They themselves will be potentially losing funding for offering programmes of education. There are many other organisations who will be impacted. How much is that likely to have something that we should be trying to evaluate, or is it too speculative at this point in order to review local plan? Should we be doing it? And has any of this been considered? I'm not suggesting that you haven't thought about it. I'm suggesting, has it actually been considered by officers? I have one other, but perhaps you want to pick those up. Thank you.
I'll just start with the issue of Gorebridge, or the wider issue. Scottish Government, yes, do obviously, in terms of their review of building standards, which comes about every 2 or 3 years, they review and update them. And they have a pretty extensive sort of national debate with the local authorities, building standards officers. It's quite a good link and a strong link, and we feed into that as well. So if there are some international or national studies or information coming out in relation to seismology or particular issues to do with geomorphology, then that can be picked up if that's issues which are going to affect the ground conditions, which then affect the buildings which are going to be placed upon that ground. So that's the wider aspects to it. In terms of the more local, then part of the work on the consultations on the interim policy are also involving experts in the field of site investigation, of understanding gasification and all that sort of stuff, and the practicalities and the difficulties of trying to understand, you know, how gas moves around underground, how a gas, CO2, which is heavier than air, ends up coming out of the ground into property, all those sorts of issues. And so part of the work we're doing is in relation to discussing with the technicals, people who know that side of things, and they're happy to input to that, to try and get a better understanding. Because you know, here we have two incidences. It's still very early days to some extent. You couldn't necessarily put your hand on your heart and say, absolutely, I know the reason why that gas is there. So there's all that going on at the present time. And we need to pick up on the benefits of that work to look at how we then take that interim policy forward. In relation to Brexit, local plan, there's a little bit of impact on local plan, but I think probably the main focus of our activity needs to be one of the strategies that flows from that local plan or is linked to it, which is the economic development strategy, or Ambitious Midlothian, which is still talked about. And yes, the impact of Brexit, obviously in terms of Scottish Government, Scottish enterprise in particular, are needing to really get to grips with that. We're still not clear in terms of how it affects the EU funding programmes. Although, as I said in my introduction, that we appear to be getting better news than the worry that was started out with in early July. The universities are apparently particularly affected because not just of students, but also researchers and staff. The evidence we seem to be getting from, in terms of the University of Edinburgh, I've not had any alarms from them in relation to the sort of particular life sciences side of things which they're involved with, or the Roslin Institute. I'm not getting anything from them. The specific issue of QMU, I am aware of, and that's something which we are picking up. It's still very much a sort of a movable feast. We're just not sure where this is all going to drop, but in a sense, what we have to do is just to keep on top of it. Terms of such things as LEADER funding, for example, where we've had a bit of a stop-go on LEADER, but at the moment we're into go mode, so we're just moving on as quickly as we can with that.
My final question is about partially Brexit-related, but it's about its impact on sterling. And we have seen such a massive fall in the value of sterling. How much is this going to impact, as far as we can tell at this time, on all of these plans? Because obviously there's implications. It's a really unfortunate timing for us in particular, given that we have this opportunity with the Blueprint Programme, and clearly it must be impacting on cash flow and available confidence in plans as we develop forward. And I wondered, has anyone cast the runes insofar as it's possible to do so, with that reference to the massive drop in sterling? Thank you.
Probably only say, in terms of the wider issue, I know that the head of finance, along with colleagues in other councils, have the benefit of independent external expert advice in relation to the Scottish economy and factors that are impacting upon that, which includes the sort of fall in sterling. At a local business development level, great for exporters, and that's something which I think we should just capitalise on. Okay, not good if you're going on holiday, but for exporters, it's excellent. So there's opportunity there with a sort of silver lining to that cloud. But I suppose the biggest worry of all is business confidence, because if that starts to fall, then we really do get into difficulties. But to some extent, we're obviously in the hands of just how the banks or the central banks finally settle it and get some confidence back and some certainty into what the exchange rate will be. Meantime, I think for our local level, we just have to maintain that close relationship with businesses and to ensure that, you know, wherever we can assist as far as we can in terms of our particular powers with businesses, then we will. It may involve, say, some lending, which we can do under the East of Scotland Investment Fund, or what's now going to be Business Loan Scotland. So there are opportunities for councils to help, albeit in a limited way.
Thank you. Peter, and then Joe.
Thank you for a very interesting report. I'd like to bring up two things. One is the issue that your colleague Mary and your neighbour have been working on, which is the Mayfield Town Centre and Bockwood Court. Is that also part of serving the communities? And then the second one is another one. So.
Yeah, in terms of the work, as you know, there's the three priority communities in Midlothian, of which Mayfield East House is one of them. That's the focus, therefore, for particular attention in relation to some of the issues which are affecting that particular community. And there are different profiles for each of the three priority communities. It certainly comes within services to communities. As you know, there's a services to communities review and a board which is active within the council at officer level, chaired by Evelyn McHugh, and which I'm the project officer for. That is looking at how we engage in some form of step change to how we can engage with communities. That's not to say that what's been going up to date is wrong or poor. It's not, but we can do a lot more. The impact of the Community Empowerment Act, which I mentioned briefly, is going to be significant and is going to require the public sector to engage in a much more, in a much different way with its communities. So the work that's been going on in relation to the Mayfield area, then that is, in a sense, a forerunner or an element of how that greater level of engagement is going to be undertaken.
Thank you. The second question is, building the capacity of community councils in the third sector to engage fully in community planning and neighbourhood planning work to achieve demonstrable outcomes for their communities. Now, I have two quite well-run community councils, first of all Mayfield and East Houses, and secondly New Battle and S Bank. And both of those community councils have been doing quite a lot of work as far as planning is concerned, and they feel, to put it mildly, that they are being circumvented. They don't feel that there is the willingness by Midlothian Council to listen to them as much as they would like. Now, I'm not accusing you, but that is really the feedback that I get when I go to community councils. And while I really feel that the community councils need to get a much, much more important role within Midlothian, I do really welcome this event and you being involved in that and seeing it as an emerging challenge. But I would like to hear a bit more of how you really effectively will get them to feel that you are listening to them.
I mean, a lot of that work is currently in preparation, and it's still to be sort of, it's still to go through the Services Communities Board. I'm currently writing reports in relation to that board, which they'll see quite soon, and then on into the wider management team through the executive team and the chief executive. But essentially what we're looking to do is to have a much broader based approach to how we engage with communities, and to look at really engaging with them in terms of the Christie principles, which is about co-production. In other words, communities having a greater say and a greater role in terms of how services are delivered, and also what's called community capacity building, which, as its name suggests, is trying to get that broader base of community activity, community support, not necessarily depending upon a few souls who take such a load at community level and who probably you could name very easily. So that's the essence of it, and that is really the way in which community planning will be driven by the Community Empowerment Act. So there's no choices here. That's the direction of travel. And also the direction of travel where councils across the country are challenged in terms of, you know, resourcing the level of service that they want to put forward. So that's the broad base to it. Just a quick one on in terms of the planning. Yeah, I'm aware that planning is a conflict anyway. You can't get away from it. Planning proposals are ones which engender conflict, and that's just the nature of the planning process. And even with individual planning applications, there are winners and losers in terms of whether an application is passed, whether objectors are successful. What I would say is that often my experience, if I may speak frankly, is that some individuals on a community council who have taken against a particular planning application, if that then is passed, then feel as if they've been disempowered. Now, they haven't been. They've engaged in the planning process, and the planning process has come out with a result. If if the planning service is not engaged properly with the Community Council, that's a different matter. That's a failure, and that's something which we would pick up. But in terms of the day-to-day decisions on planning applications, yes, there will be people who feel it was not an appropriate decision to approve it or reject it, but that's just the nature of the planning system. What I have said, just as a final one, I've always said right from my time here when I started, I will always go out on invitation to community councils and speak to them about planning or about particular planning issues. I'm glad to say I've done about two-thirds of them now, and I've been back to some of them more than once, but I'm always happy to do that.
Joe, then Brian.
Ian, you'll be happy to know that I'm not looking for a response to what I'm going to say here. With regard to the improvement to Pennycook Town Centre, I just want to acknowledge the work of you and your team, you and Rod Lugg, in putting forward that bid that day in Pennycook Town Hall. I'm happy to say that the three elected members all turned up, the Community Council were represented, and lots of local interests were represented there. And I think that impressed the Lottery Heritage people and Scottish Heritage Enterprise people as well. So hopefully the bid will come through in January and we can get work started to improve Pennycook Town Centre. Thank you.
Joe. Brian.
Yeah, interesting debates and discussions, but you know, when the Community Council is engaged fully with the Midlothian local plan and then find the rug taken away from their feet, you know, on future dates, that does, you know, they seem to be disenfranchised on it as well. I know we there were lots of different reasons in different areas, and I'm not going to be specific on any one, but when you've really seen the Midlothian local plan get so consulted on and get formulated, you know, and then something comes that's contrary to the plan, you know, and the community councils are saying, how did that happen? You know, and they're not being fully engaged with as effectively engagement as what they're looking for. I asked a question specifically on LEADER. You know, is LEADER now at a stage that we cannot allocate any other money and other projects to it? You know, have we got enough projects ring fenced for what we've got as such, or is Newton Grange Town Centre still eligible for LEADER plus money, or indeed any other area? And the concerning question or the point that you raised on Newton Grange Town Centre, as there's vacant sites, you know, I'd like you to be more specific and tell me where the vacant sites are in Newton Grange Town Centre. And my final point on a development plan, you know, the added value of a development plan is truly development. You know, it's not replacement or realignment, right, or reconstituting or whatever. You know, is it what added value is potentially we're going to get from a development plan? And added services or added facilities, added, not replaced.
Okay, in terms of the community council's concern about the development plan, I fully accept that, and as I say, I'm always open to meet with the community councils or Gorbridge Community Council in particular, and to go through matters with them. So that offer is there. In terms of LEADER. Excuse me. As of today, I am not aware of any break being put on LEADER. So, in other words, people can come forward with their proposals and they can be considered by the local advisory group who make the decisions on funding. I understand the latest announcement from Scottish Government was that certainly the likelihood was that LEADER funding and other programmes would be honoured up until the point of the EU's of the exit, formal exit of Britain from the EU, which obviously is some time away, and certainly would suggest it's within the period of the programme of LEADER, which is to run to 2020. So all I would say presently to anyone who's looking to any community that's going to come forward with a proposal, do so without delay. We have a full team of LEADER officers in place, paid for by the LEADER programme, I hasten to add. So we've got a coordinator and two other staff, and they have plenty of capacity to engage with people and to come forward with bids, and we are getting those shot through to the local advisory group without delay to move them on. And my expectation is at the moment is that we will run the LEADER programme as it is until someone starts to tell us otherwise. In terms of Newton Grange Town Centre, was it Newton Grange Town Centre you were talking about? I think that is something which is clearly going to need to be addressed through this master planning work. Planning policies only take you so far, and at some point the market needs to pick up those vacant sites. So we need to create the conditions which are going to be favourable towards the market. Well, there's vacant premises, but there's also a vacant site. There's one opposite the church, for example, which is owned by the council, which was land that was cleared. So there's other sites that may well come forward as part of that work on the master planning. But that's something which is through community engagement, which is the important part of that master planning work. In terms of development plan, well, the service provision, as I mentioned earlier, the service provision to support new development coming forward is something which is hopefully properly planned through the local development plan and the more detailed work that follows with that, and with appropriate level of contribution from developers towards the consequential impact of their development. That's the added value, if you like, is where new development comes forward and will be the catalyst for additional services. In terms of retail services, you'd say, well, if in fact you have a larger population within a particular centre, then the chances are you are going to attract some level of retail interest, the level of which it's very difficult to gauge, very much obviously dependent on the market.
Okay, Ian, thank you for that. If there are no further questions. Okay, Ian, thank you. Could we move on to 4.2, education, quarter two performance reporting? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Craig Biddick. I've recently arrived in the authority, and I'm standing in today for Dr. Mary Smith. I'm the Senior Education Manager for Quality Improvement. The quarter two report overall is positive and paints an improving picture. I'll just mention or go through the key areas that are highlighted in the front page of our section of the report. The first area is improving attendance. There's a new dashboard facility in schools which is web-based, which allows proactive intervention in schools. It highlights information about students across classes and can also give us information about the SIMD in relation to attendance. The key figures highlighted there in primary school, the attendance figures for 2016-17 currently are at 96.13%, and we note that that's the highest recorded quarterly attendance ever reported for primary schools, and the secondary schools figure at 91.7% is the highest recorded quarterly attendance figure for the last 2 years. In terms of reducing exclusions, again, the dashboard highlights or gives information about exclusions in schools, and that's helping drive improvement because we know that exclusions are a barrier to having students in school and educating them. Again, it's about proactive strategies, and we note there that primary exclusions have reduced from 63 to 47 in this quarter, while secondary indicators on target and reduction there is from 144 to 76 in quarter two. And although some of those movements look small, they're actually quite significant in terms of the overall picture. The report highlights the impressive example of initiatives designed to reduce exclusions with work undertaken within the Lawfield community, which is about multi-agency working, about total partnerships, obviously the council, play therapy, Homelink, Children First and Sure Start. And these partnerships are supporting school to offer a range of interventions for children and families that reduce barriers to education, not just in terms of exclusions but also attendance again. We know that these will be a key element in terms of closing the attainment gap, which is related to poverty and which impacts on those communities. Area three is about excellence in learning and teaching, and is very much part of the Midlothian strategy at the moment, highlights visible learning and improvements in moderation, tracking and assessment of progress through the board general education phase of education. If I just mention visible learning first, the focus here, and members would have heard about this before, is focusing on building assessment-capable learners, which is a particular facet of Professor John Hattie's work, and also supporting teachers to know the impact of their work in the classroom and also build up a broader picture at a strategic level in the schools. Recently, Midlothian, together with Osiris Education, who have the licence for visible learning in the UK, hosted the first ever Visible Learning Scottish Conference with Professor John Hattie, and that was held at Murrayfield. It was a great success. It was oversubscribed. We had to turn people away, and the day went very well. In terms of moderation, tracking and assessment of the broad general education phase, recently there was a focused review of CFE and the delivery of the curriculum and the areas of moderation, tracking and assessment by Education Scotland on behalf of the Deputy First Minister, and that was really about tackling bureaucracy. We had a one-day visit with HMI inspectors, and they were found that we were placing reasonable workload demands on staff. We are currently working with the trade unions through the MCNT and have produced a primary guidance document which they accepted on curriculum planning and assessment, and I'm currently involved with looking at developing a similar document for secondary colleagues, which will be reported at the next December meeting of the MCNT. Recently also, SQA have announced changes to processes that will deliver less bureaucracy in relation to SQA moderation, assessment and verification, and I know that's welcomed by staff and schools. Further, a big improvement priority in our school improvement planning is around moderation, tracking and assessment in the broad general education phase, and that also will impinge on improving outcomes in some of the quarterly report areas. The government has recently, as you all know, collected data on achievement of levels in numeracy and literacy at P1, P4, P7 and S3, and those will be reported on in quarter four. The final area I just want to mention is raising attainment and closing the gap, which is a key focus of the National Improvement Framework of the government. A full attainment report from Dr. Grace Vickers on closing the gap will be given at council in relation to the 2015-6 exam diet in December, and secondary head teachers will offer attainment seminar to elected members on December the 13th. And they will there look at the steps they are taking to raise attainment and close the attainment gap due to poverty. In terms of item 5, self-evaluation for self-improvement, I think overall there is a recognition within the work that we're doing in education that we need to raise attainment at all levels by the end of S5, and that will come through in some of the quarterly report statements, and also that we need to concentrate actually on the highest 20% of learners by the end of S4 and S5, because there's some degree of underperformance in those areas as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Questions? Lisa?
Thank you, Derek. could I just congratulate everyone involved on the work at Lawfield School, the Lawfield community, in fact, because it has been a remarkable achievement of a whole community approach that, in conjunction with the various partners involved, has been exemplary. The fact that it's been led by the education and social work services of this council, I think, sets an example that many might envy. And we should not be so down on ourselves that we don't actually sometimes take a moment to be serious in our congratulation. It has been an extraordinary achievement, and for anyone who's not been aware of how serious the challenges at Lawfield were, they might not perhaps grasp how massive the improvement is. Sadly, against that, while the community is recognising the enormous improvement there, the next area of Mayfield along is very deeply concerned about the behaviours that they're seeing at the Mayfield Primary School and St Luke's Primary School, which we know as the combined school, which isn't a combined school at all and never was. It was built on sectarian principles, never shall the twain meet. And we still have that building and the legacy of that sectarian attitude. Sadly, we have right now in that community behaviours taking place in those two school communities that's having quite a serious impact on behaviour out with the school. And perhaps it's in the stark contrast to the Lawfield progress that the community is noticing this specifically. And I'm aware that departments have sent in quite a bit of support there recently. But I'm concerned because there doesn't seem yet to be very much impact of that support. Perhaps we're being premature in expecting support, the support to have impacted already, but I'd be grateful for your reassurance that it isn't just about sending in support and hoping that will work. It really is about measuring the impact of the support. I'd be grateful for your comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Obviously, I'm filling in today for Mary and Grace, and they may have some views of their own. But in terms of what we're trying to do there, it is quite a reactive stance that we're having to take at the moment whereas we'd like to be proactive. And one of the things we have got in place is an inclusion review at the moment. We'll actually really help focus resources and staffing in areas where there's a deprivation and where there is actually large issues occurring. So I think one of the things about putting having the reactive stance is that we're still not sure of the impact of some of those things at the moment, and just managing the circumstance while there's a vacuum really in terms of the inclusion review coming on stream and some of those things being in place. So I do reassure you that we are very aware of those issues, very concerned about them, and want to actually make sure that we actually deal with them in an appropriate way.
Thanks, Greg. Brian?
Yeah, mostly welcoming this report. You know, and I think it shows some good trends and direction of travel in education in the in Midlothian. I've just to recollect, I think the best ever presentation I've seen in this chamber was the visible learning presentation done by primary school pupils in here, and the best site visit I've been on this year was the opening of the new Gore Grain primary school. Just a week ago, the official opening, it was a tremendous sight to see, and learning more about the Daily Mile project and being involved with other schools that are trying to instigate this as well. I just maybe get a wee bit update. Maybe that could be offline if you preferred. But the two things on the challenges that I'm pointing to is the proposed legislation change in education and I don't know, it's just there's just been that many bills and that many changes and that many directions going, and another consultation on an education was out there, a very short-lived consultation process that I think Lisa and others witnessed at New Battle High School Parent Council meeting. But this speedy change and this constant change, it must be affecting, the teachers and particularly the head teachers, within school. You go on to mention the difficulties in recruiting in primary level. Is it specific challenges for head teachers or particular areas or schools, or are you hearing anything, that the speedy change is putting people off? Maybe even the career progress into education.
Thank you for your comments around visible learning and the students, and we know that really part of visible learning is empowering students to have a voice, and I think that's a very positive picture you're painting there. In terms of, first of all, if I talk about the challenges, the government is very reactive at the moment to certain things, and around in terms of planning and school improvement, we know that the National Improvement Framework, they're going to have another statutory NIF in place soon, and there's an expectation of schools to plan really yearly and be reactive rather than taking, say, a three-year plan. There's not many organisations would be expected to jump very quickly and keep producing yearly plans, whereas three-year planning we know would be a good kind of horizon to be planning. So that's placing some strain on us. I mentioned the tackling bureaucracy. Again, that impinges on what we need to do in terms of planning. So we need to be careful that anything we put in place is simple enough to be effective and actually used by teachers and doesn't actually impinge on their workload. So that's another pressure on education at the centre, but also on head teachers who have to put those plans in place. In terms of recruitment, it is a very big issue. And in actual fact, the issue of recruitment, the blame for this should be clearly laid at the government because there's not proper workforce planning going on and the crisis has been created due to that. We know in Murray House for every place, full-time equivalent student in Murray House, there's 11 applicants and yet those applicants are not going through and being trained. In primary, we have a general picture across all schools where it's very hard to find cover for teachers, and we have in small primaries head teachers under pressure where they're having to teach and come out of class, and we're trying to mitigate against that. We did put employ more cover teachers on a cluster basis, but those were very sucked up very quickly into just general cover across the primary system in Midlothian. So we're continuing to advertise and actually try and seek that, and there has been some move perhaps to look at agencies as well to cast the net further and actually help staff those schools. In terms of secondary, the shortages are in specific areas quite often. We know mathematics is a crucial area within our authority, and again that comes back to workforce planning and how many people we've got available. We know in Murray House there's only 19 mathematics graduates available and they will be quickly snapped up. I think what we need to do and what we're talking about at the moment is being very active in making sure that when NQTs are available, probationary teachers come online, that we're actually grabbing those and that we're actually being very smart about the way we recruit, having quick turnaround times in terms of advertising and applications and making us an attractive proposition. And I think the strategies that we're putting in place in the authority at a high-level strategic basis are attractive to people. People are being attracted to coming to Midlothian, the Visible Learning Initiatives, our Leadership Learning Community, Uplifting Leadership Program. So I think we are in a good place to actually position ourselves in terms of improving those staffing things, but it is a difficult environment that we're working in.
Thanks, Craig. If there's no other questions, Craig, thank you very much. Now move on to item 4.3, Children's Services. Joan.
Good afternoon. As you can see from the quarter two reporting, the new structure has now been accepted by the board on the 18th of October, so we're now getting ready to interview those workers that need to be interviewed and also have placement discussions. As I'm sure everyone can appreciate, this has taken up a huge amount of time at this moment and staff are feeling extremely vulnerable and anxious until everything becomes clear to them. We're hoping that the new structure will be in place by the end of January, and then obviously we will have the move, which has been postponed slightly until April 2017. The named person is still on hold, although there was a meeting yesterday that Andrew Sheridan from Education was at, but there doesn't appear to be any new updates that's going to have an immediate impact upon us, so we still wait to hear how that was going to get taken forward. My understanding is the date for implementation still remains August 2017, but we're more than ready to go once that gets implemented and agreed. Our looked-after numbers at home still remain well below the Scottish average, and our looked-after and accommodated children away from home are very, very static at this moment in time, which I think, again, highlights the impact of our early intervention and preventative work, as in that these high-tariff young people, the numbers are remaining static, so we're getting in there early. They're not rising up to stage three forms of intervention, which is positive going forward, and that's obviously the building blocks that we will work on in relation to taking forward our new structure. Child protection remains just slightly above the Scottish average, and again that's variable from week to week depending on how many kids go in the registers. The number is very, very small, so one family can have a huge impact upon the register, but the scrutiny that goes into that, I'm confident that we have it right at this moment in time. The Safer Families project, that's a project that we've just recently signed up to in September in relation to the members of the churches from the local community offering to support us on a three-year partnership basis in relation to taking our lower tariff kids, offering befriending, overnights if needed, and supporting vulnerable families. So this is now up and running, and we have an agreement in place as to how many young people they will work with, and regular overview of this has taken place, and to date it appears to be quite successful. The challenges, one of the challenges is obviously in relation to the service review, it is causing a huge amount of anxiety, and it's my job along with senior management to keep things ticking along whilst that's happening underneath. We need to, financial pressures are obviously a factor that affect every head of service at this moment in time and above. So again, we're needing to continue with business as usual. We have lots of new initiatives coming from Scottish Government and from various other agencies in relation to how we're going to support our vulnerable and young people. So again, we need to keep on track with that. As Andrew alluded, as Craig alluded to, we also have the inclusion review sitting alongside my own new structure, and Andrew Sheridan and I are working very closely in relation to making sure that where there are any potential gaps in relation to the new structure, that the inclusion review will take this forward. And I suppose that links into Councillor Beattie's point in relation to the Mayfield School. We are aware of the concerns that are there. I've deployed staff in there, but you know, we need to take a much more holistic overview on that. But just to be rest assured that we are addressing that issue at this moment in time. In relation to the performance indicators, the one that sticks out obviously is the core groups. In relation to, we've dropped to 65% for the percentage of core groups happening within 4 weeks, and 80% for the ones that are happening with 15 days. The reason for this is in relation to school holidays, and again, I keep emphasising that it's more important to have people at that meeting and go beyond timescales rather than have the meeting, which doesn't mean anything in particular if education or families are unable to attend. So, again, this is close scrutinised through the Public Protection Committee and the subgroup that sits below it, which I chair. So, happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Alicia.
Thank you, Derek. Just one observation and one question. One observation is I'm not at all concerned to know that we have slightly above average, national average number of children in protection. I've argued this before. You could say that it is actually the vigilance of the department at Midlothian Council that brings this about, and perhaps we should be proud of it rather than embarrassed by it. Because it doesn't mean that we actually have communities who are less good at parenting than elsewhere. It just means perhaps that we are more rigorous in how we approach the support necessary and intervene early. But, and I would also add that perhaps in terms of the review, I don't know if it's of any comfort to anyone working in the council. Their jobs are an awful lot more secure than they would be in some councils, and certainly than in the private sector. But on the reference you made to the item on page 48, which is about the school holidays having impacted on core group meeting frequencies, I appreciate entirely the comment you've already made, Joan, about better to have everyone that should be there rather than just have a meeting for the sake of having a meeting. My concern is, Is there any way in which these meeting arrangements could be better accommodated, announced in advance, supported to improve attendance? Because in some cases we know that it's a lack of engagement on the part of relevant individuals, and in other cases it seems to be what I am told is that they didn't have enough notification of a meeting taking place in order to make the arrangements necessary to be there for a variety of reasons, which I'm sure we're all only too familiar with. I wondered if you could perhaps comment on that.
Yeah. I mean, every core group should automatically make the next date for the meeting while everyone's sitting there. That sounds very simple whilst we're sitting here, and you know, it isn't always the case, because people have to leave the you know, they offer their input and then they have to exit, or the families have to go and pick up other children, etc., from schools, nurseries. But we do try where possible to make sure that we get a date, an agreed date. I would envisage that most of these dates were made out with timescales, because people sat around the table saying, actually, it's a school holiday. And, you know, and schools don't work over school holidays, so we wouldn't expect anybody to be there in attendance. Given that they see the kids 7 hours a day, it is crucial that they are there. So we do try to facilitate that. But I suppose it's just to worth noting as well that currently within Midlothian, we hold core groups every 4 weeks. The actual procedures stay every 8 weeks. And we were tasked from CSOG a few months ago to look at that, because it means that we do double the amount of meetings that, say, East Lothian would do. We have done that. We've done an evaluation of that, and we're shortly going to be looking at a proposal to... Actually, workers don't want an extension of 4 weeks. What they want is their our mosaic, our computer system, to allow them just to tick a box to say that they've done that, because it's the writing up of the minutes and all the rest of it, which is done by the lead officer, which is a social worker, that means that we get these delays all the time rather than people not attending. So we'll be looking at that and updating you as and when that happens. Okay.
There are no further questions. John, thanks very much. Move on to 4.4, adult community care. Alistair.
Thanks, Derek. So Alison and I will share the report, given that it covers both our areas of responsibility within adult social care. So just picking up the first one there on integration, obviously we've now had the strategic planning place since 1st of April, and that's now due for a review of the strategic plan. So that work is now underway, and we are currently refreshing that and re-looking at what our priorities were that we'd agreed for the last 3 years to see if they're still relevant going forward. And obviously, as an implication of that, we will look to issue new directions as and when we see fit to NHS Lothian and to Mid Lothian Council. Alongside that is NHS Lothian are developing their hospital plan, which really kind of set out how they will begin to deliver the services out with the scope of the IGB responsibilities. And as that progresses, we'd obviously be working with NHS Lothian to make sure that that fits into what we're trying to do locally. Supporting the overall strategy plan is the development of financial strategy and a workforce plan. I think the workforce plan's relevant in the sense that what we're really looking at is thinking through our workforce across health, social care, the voluntary sector and the independent sector to ensure we've actually kind of got a coordinated approach to workforce across all our services. We're beginning to see some movement or some changes within that, with nursing staff now being appointed into a new buyer's care home, employed by NHS Lothian but working firmly embedded within the council-run care home. We're developing the recovery hub, which will bring together mental health and substance misuse staff. The plan for that is looking at St Andrew's Street. Alison and I have now been in post since the 1st of June in the head of service role, and we have now moved to a management structure in terms of service manager levels and clinical nurse managers that will actually strengthen our approach to integration over the coming years. In terms of older people, we launched our older people strategy a couple of weeks ago, just in the local church here in Dalkeith. It was an incredibly well-attended event, and the feedback we've got so far has been incredibly positive, and people found it a really useful place to come and share ideas. More kind of work we can get involved in terms of high bank. We undertook a day services review, and one of the outcomes of that was to relocate High Bank's daycare centre, and that's moved across to Mid Lothian Community Hospital, which is in the old Cairn Green, which was the old day hospital. So that is now High Bank day centre, and we've committed that can remain there for the next 3 to 4 years whilst we look at any potential longer term developments. We have saw the closure of Woodburn Day Centre. That was a decision that Woodburn took. They wanted to move away from providing registered care to a more drop-in centre, and have renamed it Grassy Riggs, which I've been assured is the name of a local area within Woodburn, was always known as the Grassy Riggs. So the users came up with that as a kind of, I think it's a really nice name for it to come up with. So they've moved into more drop-in centre, so we're looking to accommodate some of the people from Woodburn into High Bank, and we're just working through some of the transport issues to make sure folk get there safely. Continue to work with the dementia service, and that they are now beginning to take a wider role in delivering dementia clinics within the community hospital. And I suppose that's beginning to blur the lines between what is work within hospital and work within community, and actually recognising as we move towards an integrated approach that the key bit is the right service and the right time, not necessarily whether it's a hospital or whether it's a community setting. And the team are also supporting the move to introduction of dementia beds within New Buyer Care Home. So there's a team being meeting to take that, and the idea that will begin to take place from late January, early February. wider work around the reprovision of High Bank. The kind of paper will be coming forward that has really set out what we think our intermediate care needs are for Mid Lothian, with a proposal to create a purpose-built facility that ensure that we're better placed to ensure that kind of high quality rehabilitation assessment is delivered within an appropriate setting. Just briefly on the carers, there's been change within the implementation of the Carers Scotland Act will come into place, suggesting that that will come in from 1st of April 2018 in advance of that. But I think overall, in terms of support for carers and recognising the important role that carers play, we've been doing a lot of work meeting with carers, listening to what their needs are and really thinking through what are the key themes you'd want to take forward. A common theme that comes through and noted in the paper is the stuff around emergency planning. Actually, what happens to the cared for person when actually there's something happens to the carer, and really thinking through how we get better at an anticipated care plan, and there's a plan in place, I think, that's crucially is accessible to key agencies, including places like ambulance service and so on, so that carer person being cared for is not necessarily taken into hospital just because the carer is unwell or something happens to them, and our planning officers working hard on that. I just want to quickly drop down to long-term conditions because Alison will pick up some other bits. So we're doing work with Macmillan Cancer Support along the lines of our Transforming Care After Treatment, or TCAT, and delighted to say that the GP clusters within Mid Lothian, all 12 of them, supported a kind of proposal to implement the toolkit that Macmillan have developed within Mid Lothian, and we were notified last week that that's been supported by Macmillan, and all the practices are being funded to take forward the toolkit, which will include education and support to patients as they go through treatment. So I think whilst it's a relatively small amount of money, I think the positive part of that is actually all practices committing to something so that we're not what might be available in one practice is not available in another one. So I think there's something quite positive in that practices working as a cluster and collectively working towards a kind of stated goals that across the entire Mid Lothian.
If I take you through the other areas of the report before pausing for questions. So within learning disability, work is continuing on the 12-person complex care service. It's on the old John Chant Centre. At the point we wrote the report, the build was on target for timescales. There has been a slight delay. It now looks like it won't be ready until the beginning of April rather than mid-February, which we'd originally hoped for. But we've got plans in place around the individuals that we're supporting to move in towards that project. We have awarded the contract to a provider, but we're still in the two-week cooling-off period as part of the tender process, so won't be formally announcing that at today's, but we'll be happy to share that information with people more widely following this meeting. And we've got a real strong programme of implementation with that provider to ensure that we're working very closely with individuals and their family and around the recruitment of staff and the development of staff to develop a really first-class service in that environment. I did a site visit on Friday last week. I think the building, although there's still a lot of work to do on the building, is looking really impressive. And if any member was wanting to visit the site, I'm happy to arrange for them to be able to do that too. I think you get a real sense of what the scope of that project is going to be when you see it. It was really positive to get a visit, so I'm happy to arrange any visits if members are interested within that. We're also undertaking a review of our day service provision within learning disabilities. It's at the very early stages at this point in time. We've got a clear project plan and we're scoping some of the data and information. And a lot of this is around the development of neighbourhood networks to increase opportunities for people to develop their own skills and interests and relationships within their local communities. Continuation of a number of projects to tackle health inequalities. We work alongside the community learning disability team very closely to ensure that we've got a training programme in place for a number of the support workers, particularly in the voluntary sector, to ensure that we've got a consistent training programme, whoever's organisation you work within. Also developing a games-based learning platform, which is about supporting people with learning disabilities to access the internet and social media more safely. Within physical disability and sensory impairment, the plan for physical disability is out. Within that, there's a real focus on employment services, and we are working with partners in the third sector. And a bid has gone into the big lottery, so we're still waiting to look at that, see if there's more work that we can do. But it's a clear message that's consistently coming out. I have to say, not just within the physical disability plan, but across all of the plans that we're doing, that employment and access to employment is really critical for all of the areas of people that we're working with. Within sensory impairment, some of that has been awareness raising. We've done a range of staff sessions across health and social care. Recently there was a training for GP practice staff to ensure that where people with sensory impairment do arrive at a practice, that we're able to communicate and engage with them appropriately and ensure that they get the right level of support to do that. And we're rolling that out, and we continue with a distribution of hearing aid batteries, for example, across all of our local libraries. It's really interesting within physical disability and sensory impairment that many of the areas that we're working with people, it's not a purely health and social care issue. It is around that access to the wider community, and it's about how we can influence that as much as anything else. Within mental health, had spoken about the development of access points. We launched two of these in August, and this is one's run in Pennycook and one's at the local community hospital, which is an access point for people that in part was a reaction to some of the challenges we were facing around access to psychological therapies and the time it was taking for that for a number of people. And it's ensuring that either straight from a GP practice or an individual with a leaflet can turn up and get immediate advice about the mental health issues that they're facing and the right and appropriate supports at that point in time, rather than automatically going onto the waiting list before they begin to get some of those supports. We'd done something very similar within our substance misuse services about the gateway clinics within there, and we'd really seen a positive improvement both in waiting times and in the sense of people feeling supported at the right time. So it's at the early stages. We are beginning to see some of the right signs that we want to within that, but it will take us slightly longer to evaluate and see how that's working. Alistair's already mentioned some of the House of Care and the work that's going on around the recovery hub, so I won't repeat that. Criminal justice, two areas. At the council meeting previously, we had just done, you'd seen the report on community payback. We are still reviewing that service. I think there's more that we can do within that area, so we are doing a review of that. And also spring service. Now we have a full-time social worker in place in September, and I think we're really being able to work on that, how we support people into spring and how we support them back out of spring at the end to meaningfully engage with some of the local networks that are there. And certainly the Care Inspectorate's recent evaluation of lifelong learning and employability, spring was mentioned particularly by them as being very impressed by the work that they're undertaking at this point in time. Within the challenges and risks, obviously we presented the paper on funding at yesterday's PRS meeting, so I won't go into too much detail on that. There were opportunities at yesterday's meeting to go over that in a level of detail. And again, Alistair's already highlighted some of the challenges we're having in terms of the workforce and some of the work that we are undertaking across health, social care and the voluntary sector to ensure that we're meeting some of those challenges and we're working on those. But happy to pause for questions.
Questions? Lisa?
Thank you, Derek. Could I just put a caveat before I ask negative questions that a lot of the work that is ongoing is very impressive and is clearly having a considerable benefit to large areas of our communities. On page 57, the percentage of complaints is obviously an issue, and I can see that there are, it's been recognised and measures are being taken insofar as its responsibility has shifted. But within that, how soon can we expect to see an improvement in this handling timing? On page 59, the waiting times for OT, both there's two items which are almost identical in cause and effect, although they are different areas. One's for the package reviews and the other's for OT service. They both seem to have the same. Could we have a little more information? Because I'm getting a lot of complaints from family members of people waiting for assessments or getting rather inappropriate contacts, particularly with dementia sufferers, where perhaps staff might learn to be a little bit more sensitive and gentle when they're making first contact with patients who are already confused, frightened and suffering from early stages and haven't yet got into a system. On page 63, you've already referenced the issue of employment for people with disabilities. And it seems to me really important that we put such emphasis on this because we know both the psychological and physical benefits of occupation for anyone, but it's about the dignity, it's about empowerment, it's about enablement, and it seems to me quite important, as it's counterintuitive to so many of our policies, both in health, social care, and in well-being of people in Mid Lothian, that we put quite a lot of emphasis on this. And I wondered, what can you tell us that we should be doing more as a council as a whole, or as elected members, to facilitate, to try and drive this forward? Because at a time when most employers are hard-pressed, and I'm sure we'll tell you at great length of the challenges they face, it seems to me that we aren't perhaps getting the message across that if they employ a disabled person, they're more likely, as ICAO have seen over a number of years, get far more dedicated, loyal service, where there's fewer sick days, actually, more tenacious engagement with the work than for people perhaps without disability, because it's so valued. Thank you.
Thanks. I'll take the first couple of those and then hand over to Alistair. With regard to the complaints, we've had a couple of issues within that. We'd had some issues with the dates that the complaints were coming to us, and we've been working with that alongside Kevin's staff. We had a couple of complaints that arrived with us on day 19, and it was the first time we had seen them. And some of the issues around the stage one within the 5 days is within social work, we actually have the 28 days to respond, not 20 days. So there are some data issues for us within social work that we fit within the reporting format for the council, but the complaints process for social work is slightly different. That's partly why some of those are off. However, we have ensured that we've allocated a planning officer to have responsibility for complaints within social work, because that notwithstanding, I think we want to ensure that we're learning everything we can from the complaints that are coming in and making sure that we are dealing with those as promptly as we can, and that we are addressing those and making sure that anything we can learn. I would say, actually, some of the complaints that we get is linked to your next question in terms of OT waiting times, is probably the highest percentage of complaints is around that waiting time, around that as well. So there is, although I'm saying there are some recording issues and data issues that we've experienced within that quarter, I think we've addressed most of those, but we've looked to ensure that there's a dedicated member of staff to drive forward that, to make sure that we're not experiencing the same issues when it comes to quarter three reporting within that. OT waiting times, this was obviously done at quarter two. We have seen improvements. We've been doing a number of bits of work, so we hope to see improvements there. The waiting list for OT at the moment in terms of actual numbers is the lowest point that we've had it now for 2 years, and that's been down to a range of different works. Our OT team leaders have started a level of triage work, because often what we would find is that we would have people on the waiting list for a long period of time, and actually at the point that we went to do out the assessment, what they were looking for was something that we couldn't offer within our guidelines, or we could very easily say, we're never going to be able to put a stairlift in there, or actually you wouldn't meet the criteria for that because of this reason or whatever it may be. So actually by starting some of that triage works, we're setting expectations at a fairly easy early stage within what people are expecting. So some people early on are opting out to sit on the waiting list. We're being clear about what we're offering within that. And it also gives us a much easier chance for us to, with the team leaders doing that, for us to prioritise our waiting list effectively, because we've got far more information in terms of actually it really is critical that we see this person within that time frame. So we're hoping that through doing that we should begin to see more of the impact within that. We are also now fully staffed and at the end of the peak holiday period, so having seen some of that improvement already, we're optimistic that we will see that further. We did invest some monies from the transformation monies from social care to invest in both reviews around care packages generally and around the OT waiting list were two of the areas that we'd invested in, because of recruitment processes. They were kind of only in post at the end of quarter two. So I think, again, across both of those areas, we should see some improvements as we're moving through into quarter three. There's certainly a real drive across the service for the care at home reviews and to make sure that we're endeavouring to get the OT waiting list to where we are. We're looking at other methods as well to see whether there are other things that we could do around the OT waiting list, as obviously our drive in terms of rebalancing care is to ensure that we keep people at home for as long as possible. So we need to make sure that home environment is as safe as possible as well.
Just picking out some specifics around employability, I couldn't agree more. Good work is good for you in so many ways, and we've always been a firm believer that within NHS and, you know, obviously within adult social care. I suppose there's a couple of points. One is around, I think, the emergence of the TCAP programme, I think, will be important, because I think an aspect of that is around how particularly people with long-term conditions actually think about going back to work, and things like after a diagnosis of cancer, actually that confidence, actually what can I do, what can't I do, and actually I think we've too long focused on what people can't do instead of saying actually, well, what can you do and how do you build employability opportunities around that. I think we've got a significant role as a public sector in terms of creating some of those opportunities, both in terms of health and in the council, in terms of support in there. And similarly, things like the House of Care and Wellbeing Project, what we're actually seeing is actually dealing with people's low-level mental health issues, anxiety, stress and so on, which can be a barrier to getting across the door, having the confidence to hold down a job or getting into a new work. So I think we've rolled out the House of Care, so it's now in 8 of our practices. We'll just discuss agreeing that with new buyers this morning, so that we'll actually have the House of Care workers in there, and I think some of their role will be about getting folk back into work, supporting them into employment and so on. And you know, there was a review to employability service from the council as well, and been working closely with that directorate around how we kind of mitigate some of those changes so that actually we're not losing some of those key parts. So I think there is something that we are all trying to do, but I think there is also around attitudes and perceptions of employers as well. So I think there's that kind of sense about someone being well-placed and keen to work, and how we provide supportive employment places, I think, is crucial.
Thank you. Brian?
Yeah, thanks very much for the report and the good follow-ups. The funding pressures, you know, given further debates separately from the quarterly reports, but I'm just emphasising the fact that, you know, it's almost like a funding crisis. You know, it's a lot stronger word than pressures. You know, and the tipping point was the reference made at the primary care conference we were at, Derek. You know, and you know, very often mentioned that that this is maybe even past the tipping point now. You know, for many things. So it's something that we really have to, you know, really get on the ball with this funding dilemma that we really have. But saying that, there's a lot of good work on the go, and a lot of good project work, and a lot of work to alleviate maybe a bit more in the future, but it can only ever be mitigation action. Eh? You know, there's still that major difficulties with finances. Now, just a couple of wee points on the maybe even issues I've picked up for the Hot Topics discussion group and the audiology kind of services, and the great work within the libraries. But they're talking about more audiology kind of appointments, maybe with the community hospital. And I don't know if there's any plans to increase audiology within the community hospital. It saves that bus journey into the city centre, you know, for your appointments, etc. And I think, you know, that would be progressive if we could, you know, obviously the library's there for the batteries, you know, but really for the advice, I think we should maybe have some kind of local part. And the good work I've seen going around TCAT, you know, I've been at a couple of their events, meetings that they've had, but TCAT was always told to me it was a 2-year funding agenda, and we made a few references to the day, so I'm just trying to flag up the possibilities of TCAT continuing after this current funding round.
Thanks, Brian. In terms of audiology, we have met with the head of adult audiology services. We met with them a wee while ago now, and we've allocated them clinic space out Midlothian Community Hospital, so they'll be able to do hearing aid repairs, they'll be able to do audiology tests and follow-up and so on. They have had an issue in terms of recruitment into those posts. It's a frustration that we share, that we've not been able to progress this as much as we can, but we have the dedicated time, we have the space. They use a special software that we put onto the computers within two of the consultant rooms. So it literally is a kind of point of we're just waiting for the member of staff to start, and then we'd have a kind of bolstered audiology service within Midlothian. I'll take away as an action as well to see where we are with it, because it's been trundling on for a wee while now. But we're waiting for the audiology department to confirm a start point for us, because we do know that trip into Lauriston and to the Royal can be difficult. In terms of TCAT, yes, it was a two-year funded programme. I think what we need to understand is what the impact TCAT's making, and actually is it saving resources or making a greater impact than other things that we do. So there is an ongoing evaluation of the service. I think it would be wrong for us to commit that we can go beyond 2 years at this point in time, given the financial constraints. However, what we're really trying to understand is it making savings elsewhere that we could look to reinvest by getting it right first time, and that's a kind of point around. And I think TCAT for me sits really within a broader community planning perspective, because actually if we're are folk able to go back to work better, are able to engage in leisure activities and are actually able to live as normal a life as possible, then how does that fit with a broader community planning perspective rather than it just necessarily being about health and social care? So a commitment to look at where we go with it, but no firm commitments to funding beyond the initial time frame.
Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Convener. I'm just to say I'm slightly disappointed that in the delay of the building of the adult care centre in Pennycook. However, I'm well aware of the building problems that can arise with a new building, and I would rather it was completed rather than rushed, just to get a finishing date. But I'd like to take you up on your offer to have a site visit, if that's okay. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Okay, just the one thing I think I want to come back on is when some time back, and I think both of you mentioned the recovery hub, the big thing from people that were attending it, both people recovering from alcohol and people recovering from drugs, they very, very strongly made the point that at a time when the recovery hub was most needed, or the recovery cafe was most needed, at weekends, at night, and over the festive periods and places like that, the place shut down. And if you're a recovering alcoholic in Scotland around Christmas or New Year, every house you're going to walk into is going to be plied with drink. Have we moved any further forward to developing this recovery cafe, recovery hub, to be available at times, Fridays and Saturdays, when everybody else is out at meals with a glass of wine in front of them in a bar, at the cinema, and having a couple of drinks with friends before going? You know, it was quite clearly the outstanding issue that everybody that was in the recovery programme had was having that support at the critical times, the Friday and Saturday nights, and at times like the festive period. Have we moved any further forward in developing that?
The recovery hub that we're talking about isn't going to include the recovery cafe as such. The two separate things. So the recovery hub will be... It will involve a range of service user involvement across mental health and substance misuse services. It would be for a range of group work. Some of the clinical sessions will allow us to do some of the community detox programmes within that recovery hub focus. Recovery Cafe, we've been doing a range of work with that. The Recovery Cafe is a user-led, recovery-focused organisation. So I think there's scope for us to look to work to expand that, but because it is led by people in recovery, we need to ensure that we're also working at a pace that they're able to support that. I think they're keen and committed to want to do that. It's just offering them the right support and the right time. There has been work on an online basis to be able to widen the recovery forum so that you can get assistance and support from people in a virtual capacity. So that is all obviously available on a 7 day a week. But I think for this Christmas, no, we're not at the point of having that available at those points. I think they do regularly try to run some of them, but it's not that we've set up a New Year's Eve session. We are speaking to the Recovery Hub around it. It's not around that we're unwilling to support them to facilitate some of that, but the Recovery Cafe is a user-led group that runs that. It's not a staff-led support system at this point in time. So we continue to work with them to expand that. I think within the funding envelope that we have, you're obviously aware of the cuts that we're facing within substance misuse. We're very much protecting the Recovery Cafe because of the feedback that we get, despite that does mean that the cuts that we face elsewhere are significantly, the proportion is different within that. But I think one of the areas that we're doing is we think there is scope within the current funding envelope for them to expand the service to cover more days, but we are doing work with them around what that would look like. And part of that might be about whether or not from the council we could support them to get a premises that they would use full time within that, because actually if we look at the money, they rent spaces 2 days a week and run it there, but actually we could potentially look at supporting them with a building base, which means that there was a permanent recovery space. So the local group is working on that area, but at this point in time it's not at the point of being able to guarantee that we'd be able to widen that out for this Christmas.
Okay, thanks. That's really quite disappointing. If we want to stop burying young people who've got addictions, alcohol or drugs, then we need to put in better support for them at critical times. Is there any other questions, Lisa?
It's really picking up on that last point, Derek. I feel very, very strongly, as clearly Councillor Mulligan does too, and I think it's something we all need to be very mindful of, because many of these people are mature people who have addiction issues. They've had them a long time, and they bounce in and out of the disasters that ensue from those addictions, which have a huge impact, knock-on impact, as we all know, for families, for community. Being brutal about it, not disregarding for a moment, setting aside that individual's pain and the pain the family goes through, if we just look at the brutal, raw cost of the impact of the behaviour that then follows, surely it makes sense to look at doing this differently. That's not to disregard the fact that this is a user-led service, which obviously is working far better than most things that have been put in place. But to pick up on Derek's point about the provision, when we look at times like Christmas and New Year, we know that's when we will see a massive surge in the number of people who will be taken into custody as a consequence of those addictions, a direct consequence, and that will trigger a whole series of interventions that are required of us as a local authority, which doesn't make any kind of sense to me. And please forgive me if I'm being dense about this. But surely we need to recognise that we must put something in place. And if it isn't the user-led cafe, we must put something in place that's... We know that the churches do what they do, as well as they do, but for a lot of people who suffer from these addictions, they're actually the last places that they will go. And if you talk to, and I should declare an interest here, as a trustee of the Salvation Army and a board member, I can tell you that a lot of sufferers of these horrible diseases will tell me that they won't go into the Salvation Army for sure. So surely we must look at doing something, even if it's an entirely temporary measure, looking at appealing to voluntary sector organisations to work with us to provide something over this period. Derek, I hope that you can join me in this, and there's something more that we can do.
I mean, I'm certainly happy to explore that. I was, the real benefits of the Recovery Cafe is the people in recovery who are leading that, and that's the real benefit, and the fact that people who are at the early stages of the recovery feel able to access that in a way that they don't always feel as comfortable accessing when it's a staff-led approach. But very happy to take away for us to explore if there is something that we can definitely offer at some of those key times. That's not to say that some of the voluntary organisations aren't offering something, but it's just to say that the Recovery Cafe per se hasn't opened up to cover that full remit. But I'm happy to report back to give some advice about what we will look to put in place over that Christmas New Year period.
Perhaps if it's not too presumptuous, could I ask that perhaps you take that back directly to the chair so that he's aware of what's happening in advance of Christmas, and perhaps copy me in? Thank you.
Okay, yeah, I think there comes a time where you get kind of tired of sitting in your communities watching young people getting buried because they've got these addictions, and there seems to be no hope for them. It's well over a year since we attended the Recovery Cafe, and it was quite clearly the users that were clearly saying, here's what we need. We need something at the weekends. We need something during special occasions, festive occasions, stuff like that. and without that there, it makes it all the harder for them to stay in that recovery mode. So I think it is important. Okay, if there's no further questions, can we move on to the last item for this morning's agenda? And that is, thanks Alison and Alistair. 4.5, Customer and Housing Services, Kevin.
Thanks, Chair. In terms of the past quarter for Customer and Housing Services, we saw the end of the right to buy policy in Scotland. This was reported to Cabinet separately. We'd seen a significant reduction in terms of the effect of the housing stock in Midlothian to near just 7,500 properties which had been sold under the right to buy. In contrast to that, in the last quarter, the social housing programme continued with developments completed in Pennycook and Lone Head, with those subsequently being allocated to new tenants. And we anticipate completion in the current quarter of the one-bedroom studio flats development in Bonnyrigg, and the local letting initiative for that was approved last week at Cabinet. In customer services, the service review continues to proceed, and on completion of the structure changes which were being proposed, those had been completed in conjunction with the staff in scope and trade union consultation process, and we're currently recruiting to those in this present week. Apart from the staffing structure, the reviews included the channel shift agenda, with website upgrade having been completed in the last quarter, and that combined with the telephony upgrade and the rollout of public Wi-Fi across the library estate has certainly continued to progress that change and indeed that shift by service users directly to the new channels. In community safety, we had the successful Partnership Village, which was held during the Midfest Fun Day, with around 8,000 people who attended the different stalls and events that were carried out in the village. We'd also been carrying out public consultation and engagement exercises in terms of the community justice changes, which we have sourced back in terms of those surveys for the feedback on the priority areas which are being defined by Scottish Government for that change in for the disestablishment of the community justice authorities. In Bonnyrigg, there has been, during the course of the year, issues in terms of youth disorder and antisocial behaviour, and the dedicated Bonnyrigg PSP has continued to address those issues with the range of council services and police efforts, including street work being carried out, and we are now seeing successful outcomes for the individuals who have been engaged in that, but also the communities that's been impacted by the antisocial behaviour. We've also had an expansion of the community mediation service, which is expanding beyond neighbour disputes, which has traditionally been focused on, to a whole range of other areas within children and families, within education and within HR activities as well within the council. We're not short of our challenges, however, and in terms of housing, we've been developing the Strategic Housing Investment Plan, and that's just been completed this week, and we'll come forward to Council for reporting subsequently. And in terms of revenues, our focus is in terms of the continued rollout of welfare reform. We've had the benefit caps introduced in autumn, which is the second phase of benefit caps, and the impact that's had on claimants and the mitigation action that we've been carrying out, again, council-wide in that respect. We're now planning in terms of the scheduled rollout for universal credit for a full service, which essentially means every claimant, and there will also be migration of existing claimants for other forms of benefit onto universal credit from April of next year. We also have the planned restrictions on the rent capping of all social rented tenancies, meaning ourselves and the housing associations operating in the area. So there are changes as a result of that which need to be planned for, albeit they've now been delayed until April 2019. But again, the scope of the impact there has been extended to what had been excluded groups until this week. And for the plans that are being implemented in terms of the devolved social security system, which has been out for public consultation, and that together with plan changes to council tax and local taxation per se, are also being areas of focus for us in the revenue services. In terms of community safety, we've certainly seen an increase in domestic house breakings. That's been reported separately to the Police and Fire and Rescue Committee again in the past week, and there is a focus both in terms of community safety uniformed partners, but within the antisocial behaviour group in terms of those perpetrators who have a council tenancy, so that we can deal with the fullest consequences as well as potential interventions to the perpetrators of crime. In terms of performance, the service has 10 PIs. We have six which are off target. One is in relation to revenues for change of circumstances processing. Two in relation to housing for the relet on both permanent and temporary accommodation. And I can advise that additional resources have been drafted in to address the turnaround days on that in recent weeks, and three for community safety, one in terms of a police action, which we clearly don't have direct control over, and one in terms of ASBO breaches and the other for ABC breaches, but we do have a relatively small number of those, so any one breach has a disproportionate effect on the percentages for that. And happy to pause for questions, Chair.
Thank you. Congratulations on so much of the work that your department's doing, and thank you for the report. But and in particular, thank you for the one-bedroom and studio development in Bonnyrigg. This was a policy championed, if you remember, by the former Councillor Beattie, who's now the MSP, who pushed and pushed and pushed for this for as long as anyone could remember during that 5 years. But having visited one of the projects when we were considering this some 6 years ago, I think, that was organised that some of us would go out and visit a project in Edinburgh. And when we spoke to the tenants there, what became very, very clear to emerge that it was all about the quality of the build. It was about the quality of the finish, so it didn't look like a poor man's refuge. And I hope that lesson is still being borne in mind and working with the developers to achieve that. We'll look forward to that and hope that will take some of the pressure off the individuals, largely male, who suffer from homelessness because they don't have the points in their favour. My only other real concerns are around the complaints handling, which I'm aware is being addressed, so I'm not too disconcerted, but I'd like to see reassurance going forward that complaints handling, because a complaint handled early tends to be less vociferous and feels that the complainant feels a lot more received and understood, so it tends to ease community harmony and improve the general sense of well-being that we're trying to achieve for our residents of Midlothian. And on page 76, at the very top, there is reference to effective budget management. And I'd be grateful if we could have a word about that to see what is being done to address it. If necessary, I'm happy to take an answer offline if it's not something readily available. And similarly, on page 79, there's reference to the Scottish Welfare Fund and the claims decided within 48 hours. That seems an extraordinary achievement. Could we understand how? because it does seem to be something very, very positive in spite of its description.
Certainly, thank you. Taking each in turn, certainly in terms of the new build development in Bonnyrigg, certainly whilst it's not yet completed, the finish of that property, certainly externally, and from what we've seen internally, certainly matches anything in any sector at all, regardless of the client group that it's going to accommodate there. So certainly, yes, that stands up to scrutiny. In terms of your point on complaints, yes, I acknowledge in terms of the reporting, and my colleague mentioned some system issues which we certainly do have, and we've done some analysis as a consequence of that, because it's common to a range of services you're going to see through today, and part of the cause for that is certainly that our CRM system is showing signs of age, frankly, and it's not to hide behind that, but it doesn't have the capabilities to more effectively manage the complaints that we would like. For example, within my reporting, it shows some complaints not being completed for 140 days and 873 days. Clearly, that's not correct. The mechanics behind that and determining a complaint, whether it's been upheld or not upheld, and there's a separate field in the system for that. That's not a mandatory field. However, if it's not filled in, it continues to run as an open complaint, even when the complaint has been closed, because I do have a number of them to hand here to demonstrate that fact. So, again, I think that's just indicative of the age of the system that we're working with, and the reassurance I can give members is that is on the agenda for our digital strategy and certainly moves on to the next phase from that I referenced about the web upgrade, gives us the platform to enhance and indeed replace some of our systems, and this is one of those that is clearly a priority. But in terms of the essence of your point is absolutely understood, the earlier stage that we can intervene and get the complaints resolved is certainly one that we're achieving, because there's improvement overall in complaints despite, as I say, the technicalities I've outlined there. In terms of the budget, we are within the service over budget, but that's in respect specifically to homelessness, because all the other budget elements of my services are within budget. And the reason for that is because we haven't as yet had the Poulton Centre, previous Midfield and Pentland House coming on stream as was planned within the budget cycle. So the projected savings that we had accounted for have been taken out the budget, albeit we've not yet delivered on the impact that the continuing use of bed and breakfast has required, because we haven't as yet completed those facilities for use. We do anticipate Poulton Centre and Midfield be completed before Christmas, and February is the end date because of the additional asbestos works which came before Council recently for that to be completed. In terms of the Scottish Welfare Fund, it is certainly one of our successes, and the target time is 48 hours, but on average we tend to do it within four. We do it within a working day, by and large. It may be of interest that in terms of the proportionate number of claims are predominantly for fuel and for food. Others are in terms of crisis loans for people who are moving into their new tenancy for us, where we're not providing a homelessness package if they've not come through that route. But predominantly over 80%, as I say, are fuel and food claims that are being made. And it's dealt with as a priority, which, to be honest, is why sometimes some other revenues indicators fall back as a consequence of that, because we always prioritise the Scottish Welfare Fund payments going through.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Kevin? Okay, thank you for your attendance this morning.